And so DVKid kind of piqued my interest. And so this was December of 1996. So throughout 1997 and 1998, I went ahead and, excuse me while I see if anybody's trying to get in. Nope. Throughout 1997 and 1998, I spent evenings and weekends and, you know, vacation days looking into this claim that the DVKid made on the radio that day in, you know, 1996. I went to the law library, I went to the public library, got all kinds of books on the topic. I interviewed certain people that DVKid referred to in her booklets, actually spoke to them. People like Bill Benson, Bill Conklin, or my good friend Sean, who's one of my co-hosts, which I'm sure we could tell stories about what Sean thought the first time he heard of me or met me. Thought I couldn't, I must have been a phony, but thankfully I've proven him wrong. But anyway, I did about 2 years of you know, off-duty research throughout 1997 and 1998, and I had to at least preliminarily conclude at the end of 1998, beginning of 1999, that there was quite a bit of evidence indicating that the IRS was actually deceiving the public about their income tax obligations, that the basic claim that there was no law that required the average American to, you know, to pay an income tax, to file a tax return, was true. There were laws that made certain people in certain circumstances file tax returns and pay income tax, but not the average American living and working in the United States. Then I also found, and of course this is also reflect, a lot of this stuff is reflected on my website, agentfortruth.com. But there's also the issue of the IRS's own internal manuals corroborating this claim that the IRS's jurisdiction is actually super limited to basically Americans working abroad, or foreigners working or deriving, you know, money or earnings from the United States. So that really blew me away, that the IRS's own internal manuals corroborated and confirmed some of these, you know, so-called theories, because they're actually not theories at all, they're facts. And so the IRS's internal, excuse me, manuals corroborated a lot of these facts as well. So by February of 1999, a little over 2 years after I embarked on this off-duty investigation, I came to a point where I, you know, had to think, well, I took an oath to support and defend the Constitution. I've certainly accumulated enough evidence to show, to make me concerned that were I to just keep quiet about this or not speak up or not ask for some direction, that I wouldn't be abiding by my oath. And so I need to speak up about it. There were also memorandums that were sent out to all IRS employees by the commissioner instructing us that if we were to encounter any kind of fraud, waste, or abuse, that we should immediately report it. So, you know, this was around the time that I had spent 2 years finding what looked like, you know, massive fraud, waste, and abuse. And so everything, the Treasury rules of conduct, my conscience, my faith as a Catholic, everything was telling me that I needed to speak up and not remain silent. So I did that in February of 1999. And of course, the IRS, I presented my findings to my immediate supervisors at the San Jose, California IRS headquarters. And of course, as you might imagine, the reaction wasn't very positive. Within a few days, I was basically asked to resign. I had told my bosses that I'd gone to bat for the agency and the income tax and done everything I could to try to, you know, dispense with these facts, and I just couldn't do it. And so I was basically reaching out to my supervisors to show me the error of my analysis, you know, if there was any. And instead of showing me the error of my analysis, they told me, we're not going to talk to you. We're not going to answer any of your questions. Excuse me. And we'll give you the paperwork to tend to your resignation. So that was basically the response, even though that, you know, there I was working at the IRS office at 55 South Market Street in San Jose and looking my bosses, you know, in the eye and telling them that I'm really serious about this. This looks like a just the kind of situation where our oath to support and defend the Constitution is supposed to kick in. Excuse me while I see if anybody wants to get in here. Doesn't look like it. The oath is supposed to kick in, and you know that I had a duty to speak up, and that my supervisors, of course, had the same duty, but to listen. You know, and if I wasn't making sense or what I found there was, you know, was of no consequence, then by all means, you know, I guess ship me off to Juneau, Alaska, or you know, punish me in some manner. But address my concerns, because me as the speaker and my IRS supervisors as the listeners, we all had the same duty to support and defend the Constitution. But they didn't see it that way, and they just told me they gave me the paperwork I needed to tender my resignation. And so seeing that it was kind of futile to stick around the IRS only to probably have them destroy my reputation, because of all the dirty tricks that I had learned that they can do, I did go ahead and resign on February 25th, 1999. I was going to show you an interesting little fact that I don't know how many people know, but the 16th Amendment, I'm sure most of the listeners are aware that there's evidence that's really incontrovertible, evidence that the 16th Amendment was not properly ratified. Probably a better way to say it is that it was fraudulently ratified. When you look at the evidence, you'll see why. But anyway, the day that the 16th Amendment was proclaimed to be ratified was February 25th, 1913. And I was born on February 25th, 1963, 50 years later. And then I resigned from the IRS on February 25th, 1999. So February 25th is really a day that I never forget every year when it rolls around.
My son's birthday is February 25th.
Oh, yeah? I know that. So anyway, I don't want to just keep on going on and on, but that's the basic reason I did go ahead and resign from the IRS, and just been speaking up ever since. Of course, all these years, it's been 20 years since I resigned from the IRS, over 20 years. And they have yet to, all they do is, they being the IRS, the Department of Justice, dodge, really sitting down and answering questions. And just a little follow-up as far as homework, of course, you can go to agentfortruth.com and read more about it there. What happened in my trial. I also addressed that in my new book, Investigating the Federal Income Tax, A Report to the American People. The film America, Freedom to Fascism addresses my situation and others fairly well also. But that's in a nutshell why I'm sitting here tonight, and couldn't be happier to be among people of such high integrity, Gary, Sean, and Larry. And compared to the absence of integrity that I experienced in the IRS, you know, I'm really happy to be here. And I don't want to say, you know, there's a lot of good people that work for the government, work for the IRS. There's a lot of people that just don't know about this issue, but there's also quite a few people that don't want to know. All they want to know is how they can get raises, how they can get a pension, and how they can take care of their own selves. And I think that's really sad, especially since every one of those people took an oath, just like I did, to support and defend the Constitution. That should always be the number one consideration. And I feel that it's sadly quite lacking in that agency, and really in almost all the agencies that the federal government. So why don't we, I'll just remind everybody that I haven't looked at the chat room, but if you'd like to ask a question before we quit for the night, go ahead and chat to say you'd like to be unmuted and ask a question.
And Mark had posed a question, Joe, and maybe we can put him on mic.
Okay, let's see here. I've got to get back into my mode of... Okay, Mark, we have unmuted you.
I don't know. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Hey, Mark. Yeah.
Hey, very well. Gentlemen, all right. Thanks for this opportunity. I don't actually need to jump into the conversation. I already pretty much clearly stated the question. I've been working on this for the past week, trying to succinctly sum up what the income tax can actually apply to. And I came up with point A and point B, and it's there for everybody in the chat to have a look at. And if we can improve on this and narrow it down to where we can say, okay, this is what we're stating the income tax is, and we can support each and every one of these arguments with Supreme Court cases, whatever. So use this as a core, as a starting point from which we develop this flowering argument that no one can rebut.
Thank you. Well, Gary or Sean, had you had a chance to look through what Mark typed there and would be farther along than me?
In terms of- I did.
Oh, go ahead then, Gary.
Okay. Well, Mark, you know, you raised the A, all foreign persons, non-resident alien individuals, foreign corporations, trusts, etc., estates, blah, 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 individuals that apply to the privilege of exercise federal excise taxable activities of, you know, I think it was Stratton Independence. It says that the income tax is an excise tax. So, you know, it's the income tax being an excise tax, no different than the gasoline tax or an alcohol tax. We wouldn't have an argument there, right?
Right. This was the point A has to do with taxable activities in a particular area.
Okay. So you have DC, District of Columbia, District of Criminals, some people say.
Yeah.
The federal possessions, enclaves located within the exterior boundaries of any state of the union. Now you're basically talking Article 1, Section 8, Clause 17.
That's correct.
So I would agree with that 100% that the federal government's legislative reach is as far as its territorial reach. Is that a fair statement?
Good. Does anybody else have anything to add or improve on this, or is there any point of controversy? What I'm trying to accomplish here is that we all agree to this 100% and we know exactly the points that we use as a reference to prove this so that it's irrefutable.
Okay, well, I agree 100% with A.
Is there anything we can improve on A? Anyone?
I mean, you know, without citing Supreme Court cases such as Madden versus Kentucky or Nathan versus Louisiana or something of that nature. If you're making a legal argument, I think that the IRS and, you know, the tax court for sure, and most of the district courts, if not all of them, would deny any argument you make to support Article 1, Section 8, Clause 17.
Well,
In all honesty.
Sure, absolutely. But I go by the fact that in the manual, the IRS manual, they're presumed to abide by Supreme Court decisions.
Sure.
And point A is made within the basis of the Supreme Court decisions.
No doubt. Okay. Well, without any argument, you know, to the contrary, I think everything you say in it is accurate.
In A, does Peter have any, or Joe, does, I know Larry's not with us tonight, but if anybody else has a question or an argument, I would appreciate it.
Well, I would agree. As a general statement, when you're talking about the income tax, I would agree. The trouble that you will face that eventually if you ever bring a legal argument forward is it is a general statement. And if you're going to bring such an argument into a court, you're going to have a whole lot of specifics and legal citations and legal principles that you're going to have to be able to use to bolster the general statement that you're making. So I don't disagree with the general premise, but that's what it is for right now, without more.
Right, so you think that we, if we were to put our heads together, we could have this as presentment A, and then presentment B to make a challenge, let's say, should it be necessary again, to whether or not the Supreme Court would go against its own decisions.
Well, let me address B.
Okay.
You're saying all Americans or legal persons that are domiciled in D.C. or the United States possessions or exercise federal excise taxable activities in D.C., federal possessions or enclaves. This, you know, this is starting to sound a lot like Title 4, Section 72.
Correct.
Also, you know, Title 18, Section 7.
Right.
Which, you know, which is cut and dry. But it, you know, the all Americans, and then you have, you know, the U.S. possessions and whatnot. The possessions have their own laws for the most part. I believe that America, Samoa, and Puerto Rico currently are using the Internal Revenue Code. But without getting into the weeds, you know, I tend to look at the Internal Revenue Code as totally foreign to citizens because of the research that I've done. Seems to indicate that very strongly, but you're not going to really find it in the code per se. You're going to find it in the Federal Register, which you know, to me, you know, and I don't want to discourage anybody from researching because it's really fun. But like Title 5, Section 552, there's a passage in there in 552A that says that if it's that you cannot be punished for something that's not published in the Federal Register. And then there's Federal Crop Insurance versus Merrill Supreme Court case where the Supreme Court held that men must turn square corners when they're dealing with the government. And at the same time, they're putting some onus on if you trust a government agent, you do so at your own peril as well. So, you know, but it's not getting off track with you're pointing to the Internal Revenue Code being just strictly limited to people in federal territory. Is that a fair representation?
It is, but you did not complete B.
Well, I just wanted to kind of make that as like a stake in the ground.
Yeah, well, we fully agree on that. I mean, you and I guess we agree on that. I don't know if anyone else has a different opinion. There seem to be engaging on chat right now. The reason for that question was so that we address the exemption of $100,000 for an American working in a country with a foreign treaty and benefits from the protections. Mm-hmm. And I would like to nail down A, B without complicating it into C with a question on how would that apply to where it would be still in line with the 13th Amendment. Well, but we won't go there.
Well, what you're talking about basically is Section 911 talking about earned income and the earned income exclusion for citizens.
That's correct, because you said it doesn't seem to apply to citizens. And would that, in this case, be applying to citizens?
Right. And and so the devil is in the details. So when you're looking at, for example, you know, Section 1, Section 1 regulations. When you get to just exactly how the income tax operates, and we don't want to get, you know, so far over everybody's head without, you know, by attaching a discussion to B, but, you know, in general, you know, there was a case in the Supreme Court, I think it was Cohen's versus Virginia, and it wasn't decided by the Supreme Court per se, but it was argued by Mr. Cohen's lawyer, where the lawyer had said that the laws in Delaware, and this is in essence, the laws in Delaware have no more effect in Washington, D.C. than the laws in Washington, D.C. have in Delaware. So, I mean, they're two totally separate entities. Madden versus Kentucky says the same thing, which is a case in 1940, which overruled a case called Colgate versus Harvey, which is a pretty important case. And then, of course, the code itself has delineated it. And there's a regulation, and I'll just ask everybody to write this down. It's section, it's 26 CFR, Code of Federal Regulations, 601. And when I say dot, that means like a period after the 601 period. 601.101A. And it's the IRS's Treasury Department's statement of procedure rules. And in the procedure rules, it tells us that the Internal Revenue Service is a bureau of the Department of Treasury. And then it goes on to explain the district directors and the director international foreign operations districts and everything else. But then they get to, oh, thank you, Joe. And they get down, scroll down a little bit to talks of that. You see where it says the director, foreign operations district, administers the internal revenue laws applicable to taxpayers residing or doing business abroad. Foreign taxpayers deriving income from sources within the United States. And taxpayers who are required to withhold tax on certain payments made to non-resident aliens and foreign corporations, provided the books and records of those taxpayers are located outside the United States. So right there, you have three categories of taxpayers, foreign taxpayers. You got taxpayers residing or doing business abroad. Who would that be, Mark? Taxpayers residing or doing business abroad.
Residing where?
Abroad.
Well, by comparison with the third paragraph, those taxpayers that are required to withhold tax on certain payments to non-resident aliens, there's a location distinction between, there's no distinction between the taxpayers required to withhold, those could be within the country, and the foreign taxpayers, who are abroad could be citizens. So we're trying to clarify whether or not the code, according to your statement, does apply to some citizens that are abroad, according to my question, within a country with a tax treaty, or within the country to those who withhold from non-resident aliens.
Well, let's break those three categories into really clearly defined areas so everybody could be on the same page.
Great, thank you.
Okay. Taxpayers residing or doing business abroad. If you become so immersed in it, taxpayers residing would be citizens abroad. Taxpayers doing business abroad would be a foreign, wholly owned foreign subsidiary of a domestic corporation, such as FedEx in France. So they're saying taxpayers residing or doing business. You know, so it's either or. You're either going to be a citizen performing services outside the United States, provided that they got the rules in 9/11 D1 A and B that says you got to be overseas for a certain period of time. You also have the foreign earned income exclusion. So if you're going to be traveling outside the United States, performing services outside the United States for 330 days or for a whole year, you're going to be able to take advantage of the foreign earned income exclusion. So that's number one, citizens and domestic corporations doing business abroad. The second is...
So can we conclude then, if you don't mind me interrupting you for a second, can we conclude then that this director, Foreign Operations District, is the only director? Is there another director that is like domestic operations district?
Well, you know, there used to be a district director. District director went away in 1998, and by 2000, they were gone. So there's no more district. It's all now areas. They changed the district structure to the area structure. Now you have an area director, not a district director.
Yes, so, but this is the director of Foreign Operations District.
Oh, absolutely. That's the guy that's located. I believe that he's basically operating his office out of Philadelphia.
Great. So based on this statement, if Joe wouldn't mind highlighting from the director of Foreign Operations down to the three, from director operation all the way down to the end of that sentence, the United States.
Yeah.
We're staying within this paragraph.
Yes, we are.
So within here, we have three different taxpayers, correct?
We have three classes.
Three classes, that's what I mean, yes.
Yeah.
Okay, so the Director of Foreign Operations District is in charge of administrating the internal revenue applicable to taxpayers residing or doing business abroad, which you already addressed.
Right.
The second class would be foreign taxpayers deriving income from sources within the United States. Those are foreign taxpayers. We don't care about that necessarily.
Foreign corporations, right.
Right, okay. But the third one is taxpayers who are required to withhold tax on certain payments to non-resident aliens. Certain payments. So not all payments.
That's true. Provided that the books or records of those taxpayers are located outside the United States.
Okay. Why is the need for certain payments?
Well, the general consensus would be Section 1441 and Section 1442, Section 1443.
Yeah, but certain beats that. Because
well, certain payments would be, you know, you could compare certain payments made to a non-resident alien, certain payments made to a foreign corporation, and certain payments made to a foreign tax-exempt organization. And, you know, and I think that might be the hook for certain payments.
Not to mention treaties, possibly, the fact that maybe they're...
That's what I would suggest to look at. That certain may have something to do with the treaties, the countries, payments made to non-resident aliens and foreign corporations that operate under a treaty with that foreign country. Otherwise, if somebody... Right, come again?
No shortage of treaties.
Right, but I sent you. Well, I can provide that if the group is interested. Apparently there's only one section that seems to indicate that the income tax is only applicable to Canadians.
No.